This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk to Professor Johanna Fernandez about a talk that she gave recently at the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee and 1199 17th Annual Dinner Tribute for Families of Political Prisoners. Professor Fernandez will talk about the crackdown on so-called crime in the streets that happened in the 1960s with the help of public relations firms and set forth how that paved the way for the epidemic of mass incarceration that we face today and the criminalization of Black Americans. We'll talk with Tracy Yoder from the National Lawyers Guild about her recent report on national special security events and trends in policing. The report provides a detailed look into the mass expenditures that go into these events, the use of new media, both by activists and police departments, and the way that special event ordinances enacted before an event sometimes become permanent fixtures. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
On January 19th, the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee and 1199 SEIU activists, including WBAI's own Dekwi Kioni Siddiqui, presented the 17th annual dinner tribute to the families of political prisoners and prisoners of war. The event was called Transforming Solidarity, Working Together to End Political Imprisonment and Mass Incarceration, and was held at the Martin Luther King Jr. Labor Center in New York City. Joining us today is keynote speaker Johanna Fernandez, who's going to talk in person about some of the points she made at the event. Welcome, Johanna, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi, for having me.
Now, I was struck, as I think the entire audience was, by the historical context in which you framed today's really epidemic mass incarceration problem. Can you tell us a little bit, going back to Barry Goldwater's election days, what happened in the early 60s to set this in motion?
Well, part of what we see happening beginning in 1964 is that the Republican Party begins to craft an ideological backlash against an emerging civil rights and Black Power movement. And the Republican presidential candidate at the time, Barry Goldwater, in a speech begins to link crime to the activism of civil rights protesters that are being incarcerated in the South in the aftermath of their direct action protests against segregation. And if you allow me, I'll read to you what he said in numerous speeches across the country. And this particular quote is from the New York Times, September 4th, 1964. Our wives, all women, feel unsafe on our streets. And in encouragement of even more abuse of the law, we have the appalling spectacle of this country's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, actually telling an audience this year at Colby College that, quote, in the great struggle to advance human rights, even a jail sentence is no longer a dishonor, but a proud achievement. And he goes on. And I think it's important to note the context within which he articulates this moral panic around crime. The Harlem riots of 1964, which were the first northern riots of the period, have just happened, right? Right here in New York, in Harlem. And an increasing number of young African Americans are being jailed for direct action protests down south. And what is Barry Goldwater doing? He is deploying one of the most atrocious fears of the white supremacist South in the post-Reconstruction era to delegitimize these protests. What is that? That Black men are going to rape white women, which is why he starts off by saying, our wives, all women, feel unsafe on our streets.
Now, I'd like to add, Johanna, that I actually was doing some research on Richard Nixon, and it's around this same time, a couple of years later, that actually print and media ads were spread with a sort of image of a middle-aged white woman, well-dressed, walking down the street at night. I think it was a television ad as well. And you hear steps following her. You don't see the person, but it has a message along the lines of what you've just suggested, that crime is on the rise, the white women need to be afraid. And as I think you've noted before, it ignored the economic, national security, all the other pressing issues of the time, and really put into the forefront crime, as you said, in response to a so-called moral panic.
That's correct. Essentially, what we see throughout American history is that crime remains the same. There are peaks and valleys, but generally throughout the course of American history, crime remains constant. The percentages of crime in American society, and in fact, never before in American history had 29% of Americans polled said that crime was a national public policy issue. So what we see happening in the 1960s is that this fear is manufactured by PR firms that are working in consultation with Republican leaders, but also with police organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police and the Police Benevolent Association. These organizations hire PR firms to essentially make law enforcement the critical public policy issue of our time.
And let's also recall what was happening during the 60s. It was the heyday of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, which made the Black Panther Party, Martin Luther King, among other perceived threats, activist threats to the nation's security, in their words, a priority, and wasn't until it became public around 1971 or 72 when it was ended. But that was going on covertly.
Right. Edgar J. Hoover identifies the Black Panther Party as public enemy number one in the late 1960s. And part of what I think is important for us to consider is that the Black Panther Party represented a threat to American hegemony. At a particular moment, it was capturing the imagination of rebellious sections of the Black working class throughout the nation. 1968 was a year that saw a huge number of riots, especially in the aftermath of Martin Luther King's assassination. Then there was the crisis in Vietnam, which was challenging American hegemony. But you also had the Black Panther Party arguing, contrary to popular belief, for cross-racial solidarity on the basis of class. This was a threat that needed to be stamped out. And political repression, but in the case of African Americans and other people of color, the criminalization of Black and Latino protesters was the major strategy used to delegitimate the aspirations and the politics of this emerging revolutionary class in American society.
So let's try to make the link and explain how this informs where we are four decades later with the largest prison population explosion that has really transformed the landscape of this country. How did that sort of public relations campaign to criminalize African Americans fit in with also the arrest of political prisoners, and how, if in any way, did that form sort of the basis for where we are now?
Okay, earlier I mentioned that in 1968, for the first time, 29% of those interviewed for a Gallup poll said that, quote, crime, lawlessness, looting, and rioting was the most important problem facing the nation.
They bought the PR campaign.
So they bought the PR campaign, but I think it's important to stress that that same year, there was an act in Congress that was passed, and you may have heard of this act. It was the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968 that legalized wiretapping and bugging by federal agents and local police without a court order. It also, very interestingly, legalized on-the-spot search and seizure by police, in essence, giving consent to what we know today as stop and frisk. What's also pernicious about the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968 is that it exempted law enforcement from having to abide by the laws established in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which essentially said that if you engage in racial discrimination, you cannot get federal grants. And it essentially said the police are exempt from the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It doesn't get clearer than that. So what is the purpose of this crime mania and panic and moral panic? It's to delegitimize the influence of Black and Latino radicals, of the working class of color in the nation.
And
right?
Let's just remind our listeners that in the 60s, when they were in the heyday, these programs were working with communities. They were really sort of filling a gap that government and other programs weren't providing. Education, post-school programs, feeding programs. I mean, they were really community-based, grassroots, important social agendas. They were successful.
Exactly. Successful. And let us remember that today we have institutionalized breakfast program for poor children because of the campaigns of the Black Panther Party that brought home and humanized the problem of poverty and its impact on children and learning. And so we have in the example of the Black Panther Party a campaign that humanizes and dramatizes and drives home their broader politics around race and class. I think it's important to stress that this crime campaign, which was very ideological, essentially identified Black activists as criminals, but it also legitimized political repression. It helped legalize political repression through the omnibus.
And institutionalized.
And institutionalized it. And then we move forward, right, to the 1970s and 1980s. Part of what we see is that on the back of this campaign to repress Black radicals, the apparatus of mass incarceration emerges, and now that apparatus is being deployed against the most vulnerable sections of American society in urban centers, African Americans and Latinos that are being devastated by a crisis of deindustrialization. So a class in society that's now economically dispensable because of deindustrialization is going to be warehoused. This is part of a class, the poorest people in society, that historically in this nation, people of color who are oppressed racially, are likely to resist. And this class is now going to be controlled
so they can't
warehousing
resist
en masse so that they cannot resist. But also what we have to stress is that the fear of crime is going to scapegoat African Americans, Latinos, increasingly immigrants for larger problems in American society, which is that in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the United States sees the largest class stratification ever in American history. And rather than Americans worrying about that huge economic crisis and the fact that the wealthy are getting wealthier than ever and that the middle class is being eviscerated, what Americans are fearing are black men lurking around the corner, ready to attack. It was a fabricated crisis of crime that never existed.
And it was an enormously well-funded, pervasive public relations campaign, if you will, that I think also went hand in hand with the growth of consumerism, which makes a lot of people sort of think, we call it the me generation. If you're going to create this other that poses a threat to an individual who's being marketed at by large corporations who are in bed with the government, that helps really cement that divide and create this artificial fear, a pullback from community organizing and really the notion of we're better as a community when we work together and embrace our neighbors. But now it's more, what can I do for myself and how can I protect myself from this evil, dark, lurking force?
Right. Part of what fear does is that it atomizes the members of society. And citizens begin thinking about their well-being in isolation from others. They don't think in terms of community, but rather in terms of the individual. And this crime campaign and PR hysteria around crime really led to one of many of the worst racial atrocities in American history. So your listeners probably know that the Central Park 5 film is out now. These were five black and Latino boys that were railroaded in the courts, tortured by DAs and police officers and investigators that literally tortured confessions out of them. And now we learn that they are innocent. Well, the same ideas deployed by Goldwater in 1964, our wives, all women feel unsafe on our streets, are the same ideas that lynched these young men in the media.
And Wilding. The phenomenon
exactly.
of Wilding was so big in New York at around that same time. I remember I live in the East Village, and I remember one night police were chasing a group of young black kids. They were kids. They were like 10 years old. And every headline was like, Wilding. How better to vilify and make into animals our youngest hopes for the future?
Exactly. And again, in the 1980s and the 1990s, the biggest problem in American society was the fact that our healthcare benefits were being done away with. Many people of a younger generation are not aware that most Americans got healthcare through their employers. That's no longer the case. Well, those rights were pretty much gotten rid of in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. There's also this Harvard study that says, it was conducted by a Harvard economist that says that between 1970 and 1990, we see the largest transfer of wealth that has ever happened in American history. This transfer of wealth happened from the bottom of society to the top. When such a transfer of wealth had happened previously in history, it happened as a result of a military coup or a revolution. In the United States, it happened without a peep. Why? Because the media and politicians successfully scapegoated black men, and crime essentially becomes a code word for African Americans, Latinos, increasingly immigrants, and people who are, quote, on the dole, sucking off the teat of the system.
And one of the best things politicians can do in terms of appealing to their constituents, be tough on crime. I mean, that mantra has really been with us, as you said, for the last three decades at least.
Well, I'm thinking now of Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia, and of course Ronald Reagan and Nixon and all the politicians that have come after. Their big issue was law and order, but Frank Rizzo in particular said, crime is rampant in the streets. Morality is in decline. That becomes the major public policy issue in the United States, and everything else is ignored. While our livelihoods, our economy, our schools, our communities go to hell in a handbasket.
Now, I want to talk about social movements, fast-forwarding to now. Something you mentioned the other night at your talk was about how the Black Panthers had an agenda that they all literally memorized, and how now we really don't have that kind of organized platform. Our young people may stumble into learning about a political prisoner. You yourself mentioned, and I think a lot of people were moved in the audience by this, by the fact that when you first visited Mumia Abu-Jamal, your life was transformed, and you urged everyone in the room, had they not had the experience of visiting someone who is incarcerated, to do that. And I agree with you. I think it's a transformative experience, and it should be something that everyone does. How did it change you? And can you talk briefly about the Black Panthers platform and how you see a need for something like that now?
Well, the Black Panther Party had an analysis of oppression and inequality that addressed its root causes. It identified capitalism, which is driven by profit rather than need, as the problem. And essentially, they understood the power of ideas and the power of taking this analysis of where problems come from and how we can transform society into the community. And how do you do that? You do that in conversation with people, which is why they memorized their platform and they argued for unity. They argued that prisons are for social control and that they should be abolished. They took a stand against the institution of slavery in American society, but also they had a newspaper. And this is important around the issue of mass incarceration. Crime is an ideological wedge that was crafted by the Republican Party and the new right in this nation for the purposes of social control. And it's a powerful tool because it really works on people's fears. In order to address the issue of crime, which is in part what legitimizes incarceration, we have to launch a counter ideological campaign that addresses the root causes of crime and what alternatives to building more healthy communities are. We're going to do this by having a clear analysis of the problem, but also by having tools like a newspaper that's going to do what PR firms do for the right.
I just wanted to add, I couldn't agree more with the newspaper, and I think that it's useful to remember that during COINTELPRO, one of the components of sort of disrupting and destroying social movements was to go after the independent, or as they called it then, the underground press. And I remember a statistic, there were something like 500 underground newspapers in 1965, for example. And then 5 years later, it was down to 30 because the government went to banks, asked them for records of newspapers and their subscribers. That information was handed over, just the way the government now works with telecommunications corporations. But they went after independent newspapers, and that was a really effective way of destroying this broad-based grassroots movement.
That's exactly right. There was a huge shift in consciousness in American society in the 1950s, in part because of the proliferation of alternative media. And the threat of that for the people on top of society is that they claim that they are moral. But we have our morality, and our morality, which is based on equality and principles of humanity, can only be expressed if we have the tools to spread those ideas. Newspapers, the internet now is a way to do that. But I can't underscore the importance of this ideological battle in society. And COINTELPRO, they strangled our ability to continue to spread our ideas.
And I like the idea of the newspaper because we do have the internet, which has really transformed society in many positive ways. There's nothing like a newspaper that you can hand to a person when you see them at a community meeting, and it lives on. It just doesn't dissipate once you're off the web, but I think it has that multiplier effect.
Yes, and also it connects us to other people, which is precisely what repression and incarceration works against. It separates human beings from each other and from their community, and ultimately struggle is collective. And so that human connection, I think, is critical to building the movements that are going to free political prisoners and end mass incarceration.
My friend, we're sadly out of time, but it has been an honor to have you on. You're always an inspiration, armed with your history, which gives us the truth that we need to organize. And we look forward to talking to you again, either about Mumia Abu-Jamal or some other work that you're doing.
Thank you. Can I just say one thing? I spoke to a prisoner who called me from New Jersey this week. His name is Shaka Zulu. And I mentioned that I was going to be on this show, and he said that your show is one of the most inspiring moments of his week by week. So I had no idea that prisoners could listen in on WBAI and Law and Disorder, but they do, and the work you guys do in the studio is life-affirming, and it offers hope and inspiration for those behind the wall.
My friend, thank you, and here's to Shaka and all our other friends on the inside.
And as far as your mayor is concerned, I see you should say their mayor, a man named Yorty, who has been slandering the Muslims, a professional liar. Who has mastered the art of using half-truths. Put it in the paper that they broke into our religious place of worship and got records that they can use to prove that most of us have criminal records. You can't be a Negro in America and not have a criminal record. Martin Luther King has been to jail. Please. James Farmer has been to jail. Why, you can't name a black man in this country who is sick and tired of the hell that he's catching who hasn't been to jail. Charged him with being seditious. They put Moses in jail. They put Daniel in jail. Why, you haven't got a man of God in the Bible that wasn't put to jail when they started speaking out against exploitation and oppression. They charged Jesus with sedition. Didn't they do that? They said he was against Caesar. They said he was discriminating. Because he told his disciples, go not the way of the Gentiles, but rather go to the lost sheep. He discriminated. Don't go near the Gentiles, go to the lost sheep. Go to the oppressed. Go to the downtrodden. Go to the exploited. Go to the people who don't know who they are, who are lost from the knowledge of themselves, and who are strangers in a land that is not theirs. Go to those people. Go to the slaves. Go to the second-class citizens. Go to the ones who are suffering the brunt of Caesar's brutality. And if Jesus were here in America today, he wouldn't be going to the white man. The white man is the oppressor. He would be going to the oppressed. He would be going to the humble. He would be going to the lowly. He would be going to the rejected and the despised. He would be going to the so-called American Negro. To have once been a criminal is no disgrace. To remain a criminal is the disgrace. I formerly was a criminal. I formerly was in prison. I'm not ashamed of that. You never can use that over my head. And that he's using the wrong stick. I don't feel that stick. I went to prison because I believed in men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison because I trusted men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison following the philosophy of men like Sam Yorty. But since I've been following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I have been reformed, and that's more, please. That's more than Sam Yorty and Chief Parker and all these other white politicians have been able to do with the inmates in the prisons of this state.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. On January 21, 2013, more than 3,000 law enforcement officers and nearly 13,000 military troops were activated and deployed to the Washington Mall. This magnitude of security at President Barack Obama's 2013 inauguration raised the watermark of militarized police mobilization for national special security events. High-tech weaponry, mobile checkpoints, and a large uniform presence have become common sights at major sporting events, nominating conventions, and international summits. National special security events were created under President Bill Clinton, a designation that requires federal and local law enforcement to collaborate on event security under the management of the Secret Service. Here to talk about a recent report on national special security events issued by the National Lawyers Guild is the Guild's senior researcher, Tracy Yoder. Welcome, Tracy, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Tracy, let's start by explaining in a little more detail what a national special security event is. What's so special about it?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, Heidi, this is a designation that was created in 1998 by President Bill Clinton, and its stated purpose was to formalize the roles of different law enforcement agencies that work on security. So we're talking about the FBI, Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security, and also local and state law enforcement. And the idea that this much security, this kind of multi-level, multi-agency security is necessary, is the assumption that these events are high profile, will have a lot of people, and therefore are likely targets for terrorist attacks. And to give some context, there's been about 40 NSSEs since the designation was created, and these include events like presidential inaugurations, state funerals, the annual State of the Union address, the Super Bowl, Olympics, all international monetary organization meetings, and of course the Democratic and Republican National Conventions. And although these security measures are designed to prevent terrorist attacks, all too often what we're finding is that protesters who are engaging in constitutionally protected and legitimate protest activities are sort of lumped into this security threat.
Why did the Guild issue a report on this specifically?
Well, the Guild's had a lot of experience with protest defense. We've been offering protest defense to social movements since the 1960s, and we've been at NSSEs since the designation was created in 1998. And so over time, we've not only provided legal support, we've also done a lot of research and writing and analysis of the different kinds of trends that we see evolving. And we wanted to use the RNC and the DNC in 2012 as case studies to kind of look at some changing trends and some disturbing changing trends that we've been seeing, as well as to express our concern that these security measures are simply becoming business as usual, becoming normalized.
Before we get into the specific report findings, have you, Tracy, been to any of these events? And if so, tell us what it was like.
Yes, I have. I've worked with the National Lawyers Guild providing legal support, first at the FTAA, or the Free Trade of the Americas protest in 2003.
Where was that, Miami,
sure, that
Florida?
That was in Miami, Florida. And then I was at the G20 in Pittsburgh in 2009.
At the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, they used the long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, which I understand they'd had on hand in Florida but didn't actually use it. So we're talking a military weapon that, in the case of Pittsburgh, was adapted to issue loudspeaker pre-recorded orders to disperse.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think it's important to note that even though it was only used for dispersal orders and that it wasn't used in Tampa, simply having it on hand and having people know what it is and what it's capable of really adds to the intimidation factor at these events.
It does. I also thought it was disturbing that in Pittsburgh, a lot of the parts of the protests where they had the LRAD were in strictly neighborhood areas.
Exactly.
So they weren't commercial areas, and you had families with little kids walking in the streets. Let's go to the substance of the report. You have focused, as you said, on the 2012 RNC and DNC sort of as a way of getting into it. But what would you describe as the most critical findings?
A lot of the things we discuss in this report are things that the Guild has been analyzing for years now, but we look at some interesting new trends this year. One of these is some changes in pre-event ordinances, which are common practice before NSSEs. And this year, 2012, excuse me, we saw two examples of once temporary ordinances becoming permanent, which is a disturbing trend.
When you say a pre-event ordinance, exactly what do you mean? A law that local officials enact in anticipation of that event?
Mm-hmm. So several months before an NSSE, the local government will override city codes to create sort of exceptional circumstances for these particular events. And that means creating a security zone around the event itself and then limiting how, when, and where people can protest within that zone. And that can lead to limiting the times of demonstrations or the amount of people, to special permitting processes, to prohibiting all kinds of sort of everyday household items from being allowed in the zone.
And I know that the National Lawyers Guild submitted comments before this particular ordinance, which, as I recall, in one of its first incarnations, would prohibit groups from assembling for more than 30 minutes at a time, which is absolutely impossible to be enforced, and to us signaled the possibility that then police would engage in arbitrary arrests. Because how could they track with thousands of people, individual groups, being out on the streets for 30 minutes?
Exactly.
What other findings are included in the report? There's something about media.
Mm-hmm. And we have a section that was actually written by our NLG communications coordinator, Nathan Tempe. And Nathan looks at the way that evolving social media has changed the way that protests are documented, and also looks at sort of the corresponding police strategies for how they're now using social media or public relations to counter new technologies like live streaming, where, for example, protesters can show demonstrations happening in real time and document police misconduct as it's happening.
Let's be a little more specific. I know that the police and local governments have subpoenaed tweets, for example, of activists going, I know at G20 they did that, and they've did it at the Brooklyn Bridge protest in New York as part of Occupy. So are you saying that police are using the same kinds of technology?
They are. And I think the example of the RNC in Tampa is probably the first time where we saw such camera-friendly approaches by police and such a aggressive use of social media, Twitter and Facebook, to really counter things that activists were saying were happening to them.
Now, this leads into what I think is another part of the report we should mention. You talk about something called the anarchist threat narrative. Mm-hmm. What is that, and how does it fit into the police's use of social media, if at all?
Mm-hmm. So what we see leading up to NSSEs, and this has been very consistent for many years, is Department of Homeland Security and the FBI circulating unsubstantiated reports that violent anarchists and, you know, outside agitators are plotting to come to these cities really to cause harm and injury, and to bring explosive devices, to injure police, to acid-filled eggs, and really dramatic stories of violence that are used to justify these security measures and the massive amounts of money that go into policing of these events. You know, prior to these events, after these reports come out, a lot of media, local media, will pick up on these stories and, you know, have really threatening headlines about violent protesters coming, which frightens a lot of local residents and also keeps a lot of protesters from even coming to these events.
And I think it does something else. It provides local governments with what they call enough threat assessments to justify applying for Department of Homeland Security funding to ramp up their existing equipment and police forces. In Tampa, we know that they purchased a tank that is now a part of their department with Homeland Security funds. I want to add that to what you said, coming out of other large mass assemblies around the country, including the WTO protest in Seattle, we often see after reports by either police or different groups of people criticizing the tactics. Now, a lot of the after reports coming out of Seattle and even after the FTAA ministerial in Florida were critical of local police. But somehow, in some of the other reports that police had more control of, they vilified protesters, did not take responsibility for the police's part in either escalating confusion, being unprepared. In Florida, they said that a lot of the younger police officers, for example, were afraid and erred on the side of overreaction. Yet, the narrative and the documentation that gets passed from police department to different unit over the years really is that criticizes the protesters and doesn't in any way blame the police. I think that's a problem because it feeds into this so-called anarchist narrative that you're speaking of that's then used to justify funding and a crackdown on dissent.
I agree. And I think it's important to point out that, for example, in this report that came out before this year's RNC and DNC, it cites examples of previous protests where activists have been arrested for, say, plotting to manufacture Molotov cocktails and using that as evidence that there is indeed this anarchist threat. But what is never mentioned and what is crucial to remember is that FBI informants and agents and undercover police were crucial to both encouraging and helping to set up these plots, which they then use as evidence later that you know, there's a violent protester threat.
And in fact, some of those Molotov cocktails end up just being, in many cases, household materials such as bleach or a bottle or a rag.
Chili pepper.
Right. Most of us have in our kitchens or bathrooms.
Right.
The stories, when it comes out that there was nothing, are buried on page 27,
right,
if at all. Let's go to the recommendations of the report. I think that in those categories that we've just discussed and a couple of others, you make some recommendations for different people to follow.
Sure. So we had five recommendations altogether. The first has to deal with the ordinances I was discussing earlier. We were concerned about the ordinances when they were temporary, and now we're even more concerned when we see them becoming permanent and limiting protest activity in these cities indefinitely. So we're asking legal practitioners and activists alike to sort of be aware of this changing trend and to constantly challenge these ordinances in the cities where they've been enacted.
And challenging would mean that at the time they're brought forth, people submit comments, they testify, they write op-ed pieces, they fight out in all the ways that we traditionally call on activists.
That's right.
And others.
That's right. Another recommendation has to deal with sort of the anarchist threat narrative we were just talking about. We're asking law enforcement to stop spreading these unsubstantiated threats of protester violence before NSSEs, and actually to acknowledge that most of the violence that has taken place at NSSEs in the past has been on the part of police and not the protesters. And we're saying that it's incumbent on legal practitioners to sort of create a counter narrative that actually refocuses attention on the policing apparatus and the constant violation of protesters' rights.
In fact, and I'm not sure to what extent, but I think the report did go into this, a lot of the use of less lethal weapons that are now routinely used at events around this country are what is called a disproportionate use of force in terms of policing practices. You're really only supposed to respond to the level of threat posed. Mm-hmm. And when less lethals are aimed at passive crowds, it's a violation not only of United States law, but of international treaties that, to which we're a party.
Exactly. And that leads into another recommendation we have, which is that police should stop using these military and paramilitary equipment and tactics as a show of force against protesters. And this includes the preemptive use of riot gear, canine units, mounted units, the profiling of activists and organizers, unlawful stops and searches, and, as you said, the use of these so-called less lethal weapons.
Now, the last recommendation, and we didn't really talk about this, but it's a crucial component of all of these national special security events, and that deals with the amount of money that's poured into these events for militarized weapons, surveillance equipment. Tell us a bit about how much was spent just at these last two political nominating events.
Well, the combined total of the security budget for the RNC and DNC was $100 million, with $50 million going to each city. And as you mentioned, most of this money goes to buying military equipment, riot gear, to buying materials to create a vast security perimeter, which is actually just a giant wall that keeps protesters far away from the actual event itself. And then a lot of money goes simply to paying, you know, feeding and housing the thousands of police officers which are brought in.
That's right. I'm not sure if it's in the report, but I know that you did a chart with some of those expenditures, and out-of-town housing and food did constitute a large part of that. I'd like to read one of the sentences here. Under your recommendations, you say that the $100 million grant for security at the nominating conventions, which are not public events, by the way, is an extreme expenditure in an age of austerity and should be considerably reduced for future event planning. I think that when we look, as you've put it, in the overall context of our economic state, disproportionate allocation of funding for militarized equipment to really bolster local law departments that otherwise might not have such an infusion of funds really is an example of the priorities of this country in the so-called perpetual war climate.
That's right. And this is particularly obvious in examples like the 16,000-pound armored tank that was purchased in Tampa, which was never used during the RNC and is unlikely to ever be necessary in the city of Tampa. And so we just see the continuing militarization of police departments, and the NSSEs are now playing a part in them.
Tracy, we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to go back to something that I know is such a part of everyone's daily life that this might be interesting to our listeners. In the report, it says, for example, tweets indicated an awareness of journalists' impressions. Several mentioned the presence of reporters in specific sections of marches. Now, that's talking about Tampa Police Department tweets. There's also something that says other Twitter and Facebook postings labeled rumor control actually sought to counter activist accounts and citizen journalist videos, which, as anyone listening to the show knows, has played such a central role really in bringing to public awareness civil rights violations, not just in the area of protesting, but in other areas as well. Can you comment briefly on that?
The use of Twitter is sort of a very new thing, and it's something we saw in Tampa, but certainly not in Charlotte. So we can expect that it will be an increasing trend, but it's sort of just starting now. And I think by labeling these things as sort of rumor control, it's really discounting the activist accounts that are also being live streamed or tweeted out instantly. And it becomes this sort of media battle about the message and who's going to control the message. And Tampa also worked closely with a PR firm that did a great job of trying to help them really create a positive impression of the Tampa police force, to the point of trying to actually create a viral moment by showing, for example, videos of a canine unit eating ice cream sandwiches or photos of a police officer giving water to a child, you know, very...
I think there was even an officer helping a man who fell out of his wheelchair.
Yeah, so trying to show that the police are not just necessary, but a benevolent force here.
Do you think that signals the beginning of a trend where we're going to see law enforcement using social media in future events?
I suspect that the success we saw with it in Tampa will probably lead to other departments in the future learning from this example. Charlotte proceeded with a lot more secrecy and didn't use any of these new technologies, but I think that the Tampa example is probably what we're going to see more of going forward.
And we don't really have time to talk about Charlotte, but I'd like to let people know how they can get a copy of this report. Where do they go to find it online?
Oh, sure. You can go to the National Lawyers Guild website at www.nlg.org, and it's in our publication section, which also has some other writings on NSSC if you're interested in this topic.
Tracy, I know you're working on another project. Before we sign off, what is that?
Sure. The next project the Guild's going to be publishing is an analysis of the legalization of marijuana and drug policy reform in the United States more generally. And we'll be looking at the examples of Colorado and Washington and talking about what legalization might look like and what effect this is going to have on the war on drugs, mass incarceration, and other such legal issues.
Wonderful. Tracy, we look forward to having you back on, and thank you so much. Good luck with the report.
Thanks, Heidi.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.